I do that?
Okay. It did do that. How about that? Rob Stenzinger of interactive-storyteller.com. Doing a little inflection there so people will remember the URL. You'll always be surprised when you do an audio thing like this how often people will say, "What's your URL again? I just downloaded you from iTunes."
Well, you know, the internet is pretty much all wrapped up into applications and whatnot, right, nowadays?
That's true.
Jersey Drozd of Drozd. Comics are great.
Comics are great.
They are great.
And that was my goal with that URL, is that if I make it a proclamation or an exclamation, that maybe it'll be a little easier to remember. But,
So we're here. We start our podcast with a whole lot of memory hacks, and we're given some memetic hooks into your brain, but they don't hurt.
Try and CAG comics are great, and interactive-storyteller.com. I suppose it might work even better if I did like a little radio meow, right? And then a guy's like with the hypermodulated voice.
Interactive-storyteller.com. Oh, yeah.
We're doing an audio-only episode because we had some technical malfunctions with the video thing this week. So bear with us, everybody. We'll be back with a video episode next week.
Mm-hmm.
You'll have to settle for just having us in your ears instead of just or in front of your eyes and in your ears this week.
Well, we'll all have to manage. It's really fun to the technical difficulties. Take our word for it. Everyone's better off that we switched gears.
Yeah, and
moved on.
It would have sounded like too mildly. What is it? What is the geriatric senility? Too mildly senile. men talking to each other with like a 10-second delay between everything that they say.
Yeah, exactly. Huge delay and bad quality. So we're celebrating our audio. There's no possible hook for a segue in what we've been just saying.
No, I just wanted to explain for anybody who's downloaded and said, what? I want my old show back. You know, I mean, although... You know, we haven't gotten a ton of feedback on the whole flip-flopping between audio and video and what people prefer. Mm. So,
yeah, that would be interesting to hear back. We've been getting feedback a little bit here and there, which is I really appreciate it. It's awesome to see both the iTunes comments and emails and stuff. Well, people will email us directly at leanintoart@gmail.com, and many people will actually use the contact form, which is in the footer of the website. Pretty cool.
And we do get the emails, and we're going to read an email today. I don't know if that was the segue to get into that.
Yeah, exactly. We are on the same wavelength.
Oh, cool. Well, good. Then we've been doing this long enough that we can actually, anticipate what the other's move is going to be. Let's see. We got an email from David French, and he did not include a web URL. He included an email address, but not a website where we can find his work. Isn't that interesting?
That's interesting. And I would say that I apologize. It's probably my oversight for not including that in the forum.
Oh, is that it?
I apologize, David.
Oh, David French. So Google David French and art.
Mm-hmm.
Because he emailed us, and we're gonna attempt. It was great food for thought for a topic for this week's discussion, for us to walk around and do a little perambulating, and wistfully looking into the distance and wondering aloud about a topic. And you want me to read it?
Sure. See, I'm laughing.
Why are you laughing? Because I'm distracted by my cat.
No. Your description of how we tackle a topic, which it's probably too accurate and all too accurate.
Well, you know, I'm kind of being silly and joking around about it, but I feel pretty seriously about our method of approach. We've gone long and hard on this idea of being anti-guru, so we'll just leave it at that. But But yeah, so I mean, if people cared enough to email to ask us what we think about a topic, then some people out there must like our style of digging into an idea. So let's dig into it, shall we? So David French asks, hey, Jersey and Rob, I've been mulling over an issue as a young artist. My friend and I have been batting around this question and coming up with opposite answers. I'm curious to hear your thoughts on it. Is it possible to be an artist and work in other things than just art? What I mean is, I want to be a bit of a polymath. I enjoy learning and exploring lots of different subjects. I like trying new techniques, new mediums, and new materials. I'm not just an artist, but also a writer and a filmmaker, and I've also recently been exploring game design. But I've also heard a lot of advice that in order to make it as an artist, you have to specialize, that you have to devote yourself to just art and nothing else. But I want to do more than just that. I think that these other things give me a broader view, help me see more things, and hopefully make my art stronger. However, I'm not so sure about that. There is some part of me that fears in the back of my head that trying to go for so many things means that I will fail at all of them. What are your thoughts? Are these real concerns, or is there leeway? And he did grant us permission to read this on the air, which is why I did it, which is in the form that you can fill out to ask, share some thoughts or wonderings with us. I know I got to read the email, but I want to kick this one off, Rob.
Okay.
I want to kick this off with a bit of a disclaimer. I mean, we talked a little bit about this idea about perambulating around an idea. Oh, man. You know, everybody's going to have a different answer to this. Everybody's going to have a different answer to this, aren't they? This really, I mean, and I know he's asking for our point of view. I mean, so we're going to give our point of view. But I want to just make sure that I am 100%, 150% clear on this, that... Man, this is not a prescription, what I'm going to say today, you know? And probably what we're going to wind up doing a little bit is, it's a little bit of this, a little bit of that. You got to decide for yourself. You know, it's like I think of the movie Hercules, the 1997 Disney film Hercules. I know I've talked about that movie a lot. It's one of my favorite hero stories in like a cartoon film hero story. And one of the great lines of the film that really kind of sums up the whole theme is when Hercules, Zeus puts the challenge to him, says, Hercules, if you can prove yourself a true hero, your godhood will be restored. And this goes back to Christianity. This goes back to a lot of old Western myths of, if you are more like Jesus, if you prove yourself to be like Jesus, then you will be worthy to enter the gates of heaven, right? Your godhood will be restored. Any Christians out there who are from whatever different sect, if that was, heresy, I apologize. I'm just talking about this in the context of mythology. I'm not talking about this in the context of people's specific belief systems. But anyway, it's a lovely idea, right? If you prove yourself a true hero, well, and then you'll become more like the gods and therefore worthy of entry into heaven. And so Hercules says, well, what do I got to do? There's no instruction manual. You got to figure this thing out, kiddo. And so what does he do? He goes out and he starts beating on monsters and saving people's lives and becomes the biggest celebrity in all of Greece. And he goes to the temple of Zeus and he's like, oh man, I'm ready. I'm the biggest celebrity in all of Greece. And Zeus says, oh, I'm afraid being famous isn't the same as being a true hero. And he's like, well, what do I have to do? And he's like, it's something you got to figure out for yourself. And Hercules gets all frustrated. He smashes the ground because he doesn't know what does he got to do to prove to this guy? And it doesn't happen until the final moment when, out of his love for Megara, he trades his own life to save her. Now, that's like the big cartoony sort of self-sacrifice image that is really easy and clearly resonates with an audience. But the giving of your life to something, the committing yourself to something is the heroic deed that's the whole heroic path that it's sort of mapping for us. But... That's all the instructions you get is committing your life to a thing or things, and you aren't given any kind of guarantee. Like, well, what if my heart explodes? What if I get hit by a car tomorrow? What if? You don't get any of those. If we did get told that, well, if you just follow X, Y, and Z, and then everything else is just going to magically work out for you, boy, what kind of fun would that be? Hey, let's play Monopoly, Rob, you and I. And if you do these six things, you're going to win. Right? You still want to play?
Okay. Not really. Because part of playing a game is the interacting of the situation and my choices and responses to the situation as it changes. And that is where I get to see if I am doing valid things, if I'm doing things that help progress me toward the outcome that I want, if I'm not engaging in that, I'm not getting that feedback, I'm not helping affect the situation. And yeah, why bother with it then?
Yeah. But to be fair, I mean, here's the flip side. Oh man, depending, again, let's talk about, you know, religious views and worldviews. Depending on your point of view, yeah. this is our only time around. I don't want to screw this up, Rob. I mean, I'm in my 30s. I don't even know if I'm doing it right yet. And, you know, it's like, what if I make the mistake now to where I'm 65 and I still haven't done all the things that I wanted to do and I haven't achieved the skill level or matched my skill to what my taste is? What if I get to that age and I didn't do it? You know, I don't want to make any kind of like horrendous blunders. That's why I turn to people who are already doing it, people who have a little bit more experience than me, and ask them which is the right way to go.
Mm-hmm. Well, and what typically people will turn to you and those that want to share some advice as far as, well, here's how I got here, whatnot, they'll often reflect back on their own path and the things that guided them and what sort of things that they really value, it depends on everyone's own style. Some people really value like the social aspects of how they got to where they're at or their community, or some people will really value the skills in specific teachers or perhaps specific challenges and hurdles they had to clear. And so you'll get different answers from different people in that way. It's filtered by their own experience, which I think is valid. I mean, that's part of how we learn, though. Like, so we can step back and say, we're not gurus, right? Yeah. But at the same time, we do share our perspectives, and we try to do it in such a way to engender, please question the heck out of it. And don't, we're not trying to provide something that we don't intend you to try to just repeat what we say in a step-by-step fashion. It's more of a, well, of course, we, you know, this is our experience and we're going to share it. And, but we don't want that to be a limitation and trap you from what have you. So this is what's, I'm curious where you're going with your buildup.
Well, all I was trying to say there is that I don't want anybody to mischaracterize our attitudes as being callous adventurers who just say, who cares? You know, tomorrow's another day and just keep on, you know, it's going to turn out okay. The end of the movie's going to roll around and there's going to be the heroic race in the airport and the proclamation of love across the crowded room and everybody's going to cheer, roll credits and play the, you know, Elvis Costello music. but... You know, I understand that the stakes are high on this stuff. I totally get that. I feel that panic all the time. But on the other hand, it's like, you know, there's no guarantees on anything. And the best we could do is fake our way through it. So that's point one. I don't think there's anything harmful or shameful in sharing experiences, because that's a good thing. The more experiences we can hear and listen to and glean from, the more options that we realize are in front of us. But I want to get at this idea. What I'm inferring from David's email here is this idea of the jack of all trades, master of none. You know, this is in Taoism. Mm-hmm. Right out of Taoism, is focus on the one thing. Be the master of one thing. Don't try to spread yourself too thin over lots and lots of things, you know? And it's something that... specialization is a celebrated thing. You know, I'm going to go get my doctorate in such and such. I'm going to whittle my way down to this one really narrow area of expertise to where this is the thing I'm an expert on. I know we've talked about it on the show before, at least I think we have, about this idea that, you know, the polymath or the jack of all trades or the Renaissance person is only celebrated after they've already proven their success, right? It's like we go, Edison, what a great guy. Ben Franklin, he could do anything. But, you know, when the 21st century Ben Franklin is trying to do all those things, it's like, dude, slow down. You're biting off more than you could chew. Pick one thing and just be good at that, for crying out loud, right?
Sure. And, of course, the classic Leonardo da Vinci. Right?
Yeah.
Artist, inventor.
There's almost like a knee-jerk reaction to that kind of approach to a creative life, right? It's almost like, who do you think you are trying to do that? At least that's the vibe I get sometimes.
Yeah. Wow. You know, this topic gets so, it's so deep and entangled, because I think we're talking about the perspective of the individual that is seeking their creative path and choices. Yeah, I'm still here. And they are looking at themselves through their own sort of experience, but then also stepping back and seeing how society views where they want to go and whatnot.
Right.
And it's not just your individual perspective you're taking into account. You're taking into sort of the ideas of pop culture and what's valued right now and what's in your given circles, in your family, in your schools, or wherever you're connected to your tribes and communities, right?
Yeah.
And it just depends as far as what they value and whatnot. So if you think about what makes groups work, a lot of times people find a significant role, something that they can do that is important of service for that given group. And that may be a pretty defining thing about their day-to-day experience. And then, so if you ask them, well, what's really important? They're going to talk about that finding something individual and focused. And that is a badge, a sash, a sign that you wear, and people know to come to you for that thing. Because otherwise, what do you do in this village, right?
Yeah. Like if you are the village tinkerer, that's a lot different than being the village blacksmith. The village mechanic, or the village plumber, the village dentist.
So putting up with I bet the Ben Franklins, Leonardo da Vinci's, all of those people were probably of extremely wild, varying opinion as far as the folks in their village, as far as who do you use them for. I don't know. Ben Franklin started up the same business that I'm doing. He wasn't doing it last week, but now he is. I think he's a jerk. And then someone else is going to think, well, everyone's going to get their own thing out of that.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, I'm reminded of the Richard Feynman quote that I love to pull out in times like this is, you listen to what others say, you compare it to what you know to be true, and if it doesn't agree with what you know to be true, then that's that. Move on. Kind of a harsh way to look at things, but it's a liberating way to look at things sometimes. It frees you up to not have to carry that baggage of what everybody else is thinking about what your decisions are. Again, I'm not talking about like a kind of like punk FU defiance, but more of a, well, you know, we don't agree on this. But it's also easy to even talk about people like Ben Franklin or Leonardo da Vinci, because those are super famous, successful, well-known examples. I'm sure there are countless, countless examples of Renaissance people, jacks of all trades, in between all these, on a spectrum of different levels of fame and notoriety and achievement. And then we're also talking about, I don't want to go necessarily in this direction, but we're talking about the difference between, what are you really after? Are you after self-satisfaction? Are you after notoriety? What is your ultimate goal of, what are you trying to get out of the work anyway? That's another whole ball of wax that we could table for a different discussion. Mm-hmm. But anyway, it felt like that needed to be touched on, is that if somebody's worrying about this, it sounds like, I mean, I don't want to apply this to David, but it seems like a lot of time that concern comes out from outside sources, right? It's like, I've heard a lot of advice that in order to make it as an artist, you have to specialize. That came from someplace else, right?
Well, let me harp on that point just for a second.
Sure.
So the urge to specialize, whether it's from you or whether someone's sharing that advice, saying, well, you're not going to find your role of significance, or you're not going to be able to engage in trade, and
That's a nicer way of putting it, Rob. Thank you.
What?
Engaging in trade, right? I mean, because that encompasses the whole bag, doesn't it? It encompasses whether you are notable. It encompasses whether you are making a living at it, whether you're sustaining yourself, and whether you have the respect of your peers. Mm. All of those things are covered by engaging in trade.
Thanks, man. That comes from I don't have a title for the collection of four things that are like four concerns that I've been using. That it's a list I came up with when I was trying to figure out, well, how do I do what I want to love and get paid for it, right? And those four things are, I want to do what I love for. That's number one. Number two, for a community I care about. Number three, using tools and methods I believe in. And number four, to engage in a sustainable trade. Yep. And like it's pretty weighted. Like every word in there is like a critical component.
Yeah.
Overall.
That's a noble credo. You should make a coat of arms out of that.
Not a bad idea. Yeah. Okay. Actually, that sounds like
serious. I mean, like it sounds like it's like a 21st century artist sort of like knightly code. Right? Hmm. It's like fun. what are knights supposed to do? They're supposed to protect the weak and always be honest, and it sounds very similar, like in that kind of like code of conduct.
It's my creative coat of arms.
Yeah.
You rock. I have been hungering for a title for that for ages now. Thank you.
Now you can put it on a shield to defend yourself against wicked people. Anyway, so this idea of engaging in trade you were talking about.
Let's see. So I think I was going along the lines of,
you have to pick one thing, and then
the focus and the specialization because that's one way to. That's okay. So let's take your activities day in, day out. If you have enough hours and time and effort put to one specific thing, you're going to sort of build up something. You're probably going to make more people know what you do and be perhaps succeeding in trading with it or whatnot. I mean, if you focus, that can help. No, it's more energy goes into one concern. You can possibly do more with that. There, and I can really get behind the idea of specialization, even though I don't think that's the only way to look at it, because as long as you're not dead after you finish specialized on something, you get to continue doing things. Yeah. So maybe there's a sequence. You chain together different things that you specialize in from time to time. And that's where I think there's a little bit of a hole in the whole. I interpret the Taoist statement you mentioned earlier differently, where there's a lot of emphasis put in the Tao Te Ching on being in the moment.
Yeah. And being flexible and yielding. The big stiff tree, the big mighty oak, when the big hurricane comes, it gets uprooted and knocked over. The flexible little plant that bends with the wind is still there. It's still living. Flexible and yielding is the quality of something that's emphasizing the Tao, right? Water that's like, it's soft, it doesn't hurt, but over the course of centuries, by being persistent and being what it is, it can carve through rock and all that stuff.
Exactly, and that's the same thing with your efforts over time. And when you have that kind of focus, you know that, well, if your mountain is somehow accomplishing creative results in a lot of different disciplines or that are intertwined, that will be quite a mountain, and your stream will have to be wearing at that for a lot longer than if it were essentially a brief creative project where we're just sort of like a pile of noodles that you could easily soften. But one more thing, as far as the specialization in the Tao, I think through there's another way to look at it. It's through that focus, you can gain familiarity and experience with the idea of mastering something. And then you can pick that up and do other things with it. Because sure, you've built up skill in a given pursuit. So let's say, I was actually chatting with some friends about this in recent months about their daughter who's very interested in drawing manga and whatnot, and they were wondering about, well, what's she going to do professionally and where does this go from here and what about other interests and all that. And she's really talented. And I thought, well, if someone can gain like a really deep understanding and push themselves in a certain area, you have to focus on that for a while, but then you will see some kind of transformation where your results will get even better. And you might have changed in the process of producing those results. And your experience now, you know what it's like to really kick ass at something. Yep. And that's portable.
The whole idea of like, once you get a taste of success, you'll find out that it suits you, right? Achieving a victory in one field will make it that much more easy for you to achieve victories in other fields. Not always, every time, but anyway.
Exactly. So I avoid that lock-in. There you go. Sorry, Jersey. Go ahead.
Talking about being in the moment for a second, you talked about a transformation happening. Let me ask you this. If you can, put yourself in the mindset of where you were when you were 20, if you can. And, well, you know, it's no small task to really, you know, put yourself into another place where you were. You can sort of remember, but mm-hmm. are you seeking the things now in your art that you were when you were 20 years old?
Am I seeking the things that I were when I was... help me understand
Not struggling with the same things, but are you after the same... trying to do this, capture the same meaning, trying to achieve the same kind of message, trying to deliver the same kind of ideas or affect people the same way emotionally now as you were when you were 11, or 11, 20?
In both cases, the answer is no.
How did it change? You don't have to go into any kind of super specifics, but can you like give me like an abstract sense of?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I was thinking, I mean, there's some, in some ways, like I can recall, I right around when I was 20 is when I started to piece together that I had a lot of resonance between different interests that I had. And that didn't really come to full fruition until I was about 23 or so. But, when I started my first game company and whatnot, I'd have to go back. Let's assume those ages are perfectly accurate. But when I was 20, I had a lot of concern about just passionate expression, and it was less focused. So it would just be more of a wall of intensity that really couldn't do much because it was so dispersed as a force. Now with a wife and a kid and multiple business pursuits and all that kind of stuff. I mean, when I want to make something happen, I just have a far different level of focus that and a familiarity with where I want to go with that. So you said, as far as affect people emotionally, I knew I wanted to when I was 20, but I didn't really know how. And I tried to make up for that with over exuberant energizer bunniness.
You're talking about me now. That's why I talk so fast, is to cover up for the fact that I don't know what I'm talking about. But, I mean, it's like when you start out, When I was 20, all I knew was I wanted to be an amazing storyteller. I wanted to be the greatest penciler that ever lived. Mm-hmm. And if anybody were to confront me and say, what does that mean? What do you mean by that? I didn't have the words for that. I didn't know yet because I hadn't really done anything yet. I did like a couple comics in elementary school and high school, you know, maybe like 5 or 6 comics. Nothing, you know, that really you can hold up and say this is a body of work or this is a really deep investigation of the form. I had to go through a lot of different style experimentations, different kinds of projects, working with different people. And sort of heuristically figuring, is heuristically a word? It's not. I was using heuristics to figure out through trial and error what I really wanted and figuring out what worked, what didn't work. And that helped sculpt me into being more focused into what I wanted. Now, I've got a sidebar that I want to go down in a minute about like how I'm a one-note guy. Comics is really my bag, and that's all I've ever loved in life. But I've got a counter argument to that whole notion. But in any case, my point is that if somebody were to say, well, I'm anticipating the guru coming in and saying, well, all you got to do is create some goals of, do you want to be a cartoonist who has great illustrative beauty in your work, like Jose Garcia Lopez, or you know, the Hernandez brothers, or like incredible architectural detail, like a Jeff Darrow or something like that. Is that what you want? Okay, well, set that goal for yourself, and now set yourself on doing all, you know, X, Y, and Z illustration school itineraries or syllabi, and then you will get to that. Well, then 2 years in, if you find out, hey, I don't want to do this, then you're going to have to change tracks, right? It's like, this is one of the things that really bums me out about like the whole college system in the first place, is that it creates this four-year track, and then that's in 4 years of your life typically where you're undergoing a lot of crazy changes and really figuring out who the hell you are. And society frowns a lot on the person who changes their major 6-7 times. Geez, can't you just pick something and just stick to it, for crying out loud? You're figuring out who you are at this point. Yeah. You know, how you can't ask somebody to commit to this so soon, at least not in my mind. If I was a dad, I wouldn't ask my kid to commit to that so soon. But my point is that if you countered this whole idea of focus and being a non-generalist, being a specialist, by saying, well, just pick some specific goals when you're starting out, I don't think that's the time to really pick those goals. You can have an intent. You could say, I want to head in this direction. But then if you find out that that's a dead end, and you really, through investigating that, discover you want to be someplace else, you know, I see you're chewing on this. I'll just finish my point with this and see if I can make my point a little bit more clear here. When I was 20 years old, I desperately wanted to be Keith Giffen. I loved his art. I couldn't articulate why. I just loved, there was something about it that had an edge and a kind of a character to it that I didn't see anybody else doing. And I just started out aping out his ink puddles, his black spotting, the kind of scratchy, squiggly lines he used for his feathering techniques, which wasn't feathering. And then through working for Antarctic Press and being encouraged to ape the manga style, I landed on what became my style, which was, oh, working in open contour, this is a new thing. I've never done this before. This is kind of fun. I'm learning new ways of approaching my forms, my contours, my compositions in order to make everything clear without being able to rely on black spotting. And that got me to where I did my most recent work in the last 10 years. If you were to tell me in 1994, 1993, that, hey, you should try drawing manga, I would have said, go to heck. You know, Keith Giffen's where it's at. Mm-hmm. In through playing and investigating in a playful manner, I sort of landed. And I was serious the whole time. I was focused, man. I killed friendships over my comics career during these years. I told people who I was friends with throughout my childhood to never talk to me again because they were interfering with my focus on my determination to be a cartoonist, right? I was serious, but I was engaging in a spirit of play in some ways. I don't know if I said anything that even amounts to a coherent thought.
Well, no, there's tons of coherent thoughts within there. I mean, so you mentioned being concerned about commitment. There's a lot to commit to because of all the transformation you go through, right? Mm-hmm. That somehow I think what that says is that the commitment is almost like a big misunderstanding, a really like big false assumption where, yeah, I know exactly where I'm going to land.
Yeah.
You know,
but
I've never done this before and gone this way and used these materials and had these experiences. But at the same time, it sounds like you had a lot of other kinds of commitments in there and you were able to get sort of construct a path of experiences that then allowed you to become more familiar and shape things. Is that a...
Yeah, but at the same time, that path was sort of, it was me putting planks of wood through the mud as I went. Right.
But wasn't each one of those planks a commitment? Like, sure, I mean, so you finished comics. Like, you finished comic. Like, that's pretty cool. Like, when you're in your teens, and you mentioned, like, you know, it's not a the body of work that, I guess, as you would define it. But first of all, it sounds like a body of work to me. And finishing and being able to look back at it, to me, because of my experience, I really have a huge respect for the completion of projects. And maybe that's an interesting way to work around the giant commitments, is having the smaller ones.
Oh, sure. Sure. I totally agree with that. I mean, how many times have I banged on the mini comics drum, right?
Yeah.
Do mini comics. But my point is that I think this idea of trying to decide what's the right path always reeks to me of wanting to protect yourself against the future, wanting to insure yourself against disaster. And A, it can't be done, but B, it's like my perspective changed so much from the day I started to where I am now. When I started, I really thought it was about getting some work published by a company and then getting that published book to be popular enough with enough people to where more opportunities would open up. When I got my first special, it was the Antarctic Press Ninja High School Summer Fun Special. It was like the first solo book that I ever had published by a publisher. I remember being on cloud nine, and I had, you know, taking pictures of myself with the book, going to all my friends' houses, and I was singing Hold That Tiger from the Tucker movie because I thought I was like Preston Tucker. You know, this is my big, this is the beginning of the big thing, and more opportunities are going to open up because I proved myself on this one. Now I'm going to get a miniseries. After I get a miniseries, I'm going to get put on a title. And after my experience at Antarctic Press and starting to do some creator-owned stuff, I realized, I remember, gosh, it was like 1998, 1999, where the switch flipped and I said, I don't want to have to ask for some jerk's permission to do my story. I just want to do my story. Yeah. Which was a complete reversal of where I was in 1993, 1994 when I was first starting the thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
So my point is like, yeah, I was laying those planks and each of those planks was the commitment, but because the planks weren't being put into a predefined set of grooves that said, this is the right plan, son, just do this for 4 years and you'll be okay. I sort of figured my way around to a completely different point of view that I probably might not have landed on had I been committed to some kind of long track that, well, Dad says, right? Did I make a point there?
You totally did. It is different. And I guess maybe I'm being a bit impish by trying to draw parallels there, but, it's one of those things where, I don't know, I just completely hated this when I was 20. But when people said, well, you know, you just need some more experience, right? But I have I think people who are 20 have a ton of experience and different people all in the same room, all 20 years old, could have a lot of, you know, varied amounts of experience at different things, depending on what they've chosen to focus on and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And I was a pretty focused, intense 20-year-old also. I really would have told someone who shared anything related to experience, assuming that my, you know, mine led to like not being able to be effective in what I was choosing to do. You know, they could take a leap and that would be that and watch me go. And it's interesting that I think both people are right now. Because it's those commitments. It depends on how you connect with it. Because trying to steer this back toward like that, the polymath thing. Yeah. I stumbled really headfirst into this when I realized that I wanted to make video games, and it was because of, you know, reading it, game industry magazines and whatnot in the early 90s that in my experience in having like little band projects with, you know, get some friends get together and we learn some cover songs, maybe make an original song. And I thought, well, wait a minute, I've got friends who are interested in all sorts of different kinds of things. And when I was growing up, I mean, a lot of times, especially my very close friend at the time, I mean, we'd get together and code on the computer, or we'd play games or whatever. I mean, we would make stuff. And I realized, well, wait a minute. I kind of have this whole thing where I have a lot of interest. Maybe I could sort of form a kind of band, a geek garage band, to like make this game kind of thing. And yeah, that really shaped quite a few things to come afterward. But I was really going headfirst into this concern about, well, aren't I flying in the face of this specialization thing? And isn't that a bad thing? So I had this same question that David expressed as well back in those days.
Okay.
And I think and reflecting back, so sharing some experience in the path of a slightly older polymath.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's terrible to call myself that or egotistical or whatever, but I don't know. One of the reasons that I went through that is that I wanted a result. I really did want to make this game thing. So I learned more about business. I learned more about project management. I learned more about all these different things that were in the way of like getting to this goal, right? And learn more about producing music on computers and then digital art and coding. And I learned a lot of different things, but I think my polymathic interests or quirks, this is sort of a thing to consider for other polymath kin out there. Practicing and studying stuff feels really awesome. And I got really into the whole self-improvement thing. And I got really into the idea, like Jersey mentioned, of, well, you can kind of try to protect yourself against the disaster by thinking of ways where you could sort of stack the odds against the outcomes you don't want and stack them toward the ones you do want. So I'm like, oh, I better really level up and study this thing and that thing. And eventually, I mean, I was studying a lot of different things, but I wasn't producing much. And that was sort of the experience that, you know, I changed later on, where I said, well, now in order for this to be real, like, I'm not doing this to just satisfy some weird emotional quirk I have and some, you know, weird amorphous, infinitely hungry curiosity beast. I'm like, no, I want to make people happy. I want to help people. I want them to laugh or cry.
Go back to your coat of arms.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's when I formed that coat of arms. And now it's about making those things happen for people. So I think you can do whatever the heck you want as far as,
I'm detecting something in what you're saying here.
Yeah. Okay, cool.
There's a big difference between being a jack of all trades and a dilettante, right?
Yeah.
A dilettante is a dabbler. A dilettante is somebody who's like, yeah, I play around with this, I play around with that, and I'm not really focused on any one of them, and I'm just kind of engaging it in this kind of half-hearted, out-of-focus, casual, recreational way. Mm. A jack of all trades is focused on a desired outcome from all those things that they're engaged with, whatever that desired outcome is, whether it's to learn a new skill just for the sake of learning it, or whether it is to make a specific thing.
Mm-hmm. Provide a service for two people. I mean, ask someone who opens a donut shop in your neighborhood if they only do one thing.
Exactly. And that brings me to my really big final point is that I beat a big old drum called comics, and I make a lot. My site's called Comics Are Great. I'm an outspoken advocate for my medium. Now I would make the counter argument that, well, that also means that I'm a public speaker. I'm an educator. I'm a salesman of sorts. I have to try to convince people why comics are good. That takes a certain degree of salesmanship. I have to brush up on my people skills and my sense of charm, to whatever degree I have it. But okay, let's just throw all that aside. Let's just say, well, Jersey, you really only focus on one thing your whole life, comics. Okay. In comics, there are, as I've said a million times, 1,000 battles faced on every page. I have to think about blocking. I have to think about staging. I have to think about a viewing angle. I have to think about light and dark contrast values. I have to think about color theory. I got to think about line value. I got to think about dialogue. I got to think about writing moments. I have to think about drawing the human body and gesture. Even being good at one thing means that you're good at 100 more things underneath. Like when you said, Rob, running a donut shop means that you have to be a lot of different things. I'm also a freelance illustrator in addition to being a cartoonist, which means that, yes, I have to do my own taxes. I have to manage my own business. I have to stay on top of my email, which that is one area of my many fleet of skills where I totally suck. And I've got to work on that a lot. But and then you know, managing spreadsheets and managing schedules, managing a calendar. A lot of this stuff goes with any one of these different career choices. So the whole notion of being a specialist means that you can really have a profound, a deep understanding of a specific thing, I think is a little flawed in the sense that it's suggesting that it goes back to this romantic idea of, I just want to be a writer. I just want to be a writer and have the publisher take care of me and I can just focus on writing and stay in my cave, you know?
Yeah. I don't know if that's romantic.
Well, maybe
I'm debating if
me.
I should be polite about this or not polite about this. There's a way to go about specializing. So like specialists who are very professional about what they do, they're not specialists to the point of a single point of failure flaw, right? Yeah. Because chances are there's nothing that happens if we're talking about comics and you focus on the penciling. However, and so you have team members that you need to now coordinate with and collaborate with.
Yep.
And even if your collaboration depth isn't that deep, like let's say you're not affecting the plot or whatnot, but there is still quality in interpretation of the results and verifying that you're in the right direction, the feedback loop and making, there's a lot that goes on to managing it to make sure. Because it's the difference between, you nailed it when you said the difference between the dilettante and the jack of all trades. Because I think you could try to be that kind of, I think the failing of the dilettante in how we're characterizing it is the lack of delivering and the lack of commitment enough to be effective enough to deliver.
Mm-hmm.
And anyone who is highly specialized, that most of what they do is heavily defined by one thing, especially to the casual observer, they're definitely not only one note.
I would agree with that. I would say that in my personal experience with the people I've known who are specialists in whatever field that they're in, they tend to be much more multifaceted than what their title suggests. I would also throw this in, going back to this idea of like difference between a dilettante and a jack of all trades, is that if you are a focused and attentive learner, and Rob, you can either, you know, deny or back me up on this, is that anything that you explore or pursue is going to contribute to everything else that you're doing. I think of another one. Oh, I wish I could remember the name of the podcast. I'm going to have to write it down to follow it up in the show notes. I think it's like something like Robin, Sam and Jim Go to Hollywood, I think is the name of the show. I don't even know if it's going on anymore. I listened to it years ago, and it was two Hollywood writers who did a podcast about writing screenplays. And one of the things, the stories they told was before they moved to Hollywood to try to become screenplay writers, they ran a restaurant for 5 years.
Mm.
And they said the reason they did it was because when they set out on this dream to be screenplay writers, they said, well, in order to be good writers, we have to know lots of characters. We need to equip our arsenal with lots and lots of characters. How are we going to meet all these characters? Let's run a restaurant, and there's going to be lots and lots of people coming through this restaurant. That was their plan. Their plan was to run a restaurant for 5 years as research to become better writers. because now they've met all these nutty people that they can just pull out of a hat at any given time. Now, to the general public, they're going to say, what, you're restaurateurs and now you're going to become screenplay writers? Oh, man, good luck with your midlife crisis. Get a Camaro while you're at it, right? But that there was a real connection to those two different periods of their lives because there was an intent, there was a procedure, and there was a desired outcome, right?
Absolutely, and day-to-day experiences definitely inform our art, and especially as we're being very intentional about it and trying to both, try to weave these different things together that we're doing. And because I do think it's there's a lot of reinforcement across disciplines that happens. And I actually came across an article today about I was initially reading about some web typography and topics, and was actually related to the Big Web Show number 65 on the 5x5 network. And I came across this article that was talking about design and web typography related to music as a way to think, to find similar structures that can inform the design and art. And the guy who wrote the article, well, he has a degree in music. And he was finding interesting relationships between the ratios as far as intervals between music notes. And because in music, so you'll have a tone, and you'll have a tone that's higher or lower, and the relationship and the distance in how far those notes are to one another can have more or less tension. And a lot of this is fairly well mapped out, and it informs a lot of classic music theory.
Okay.
And those ratios, though, focus on that ratio is one thing. And all of a sudden you have like, well, what about, you can have that be the difference in pitch. Well, what if it were difference in length or height and width or a building block of like using the M size to inform a design of a web page? Because now I can come up with harmonious, right? Harmony, music. So visual, yeah, we'd use these terms start going back and forth related to how we describe how things appeal to us aesthetically or have some aesthetic relationship with one. And all of a sudden that you've got two totally different concerns that very much overlap and are informing one another. And this article is awesome. I'll definitely make sure we get this in the show notes. And yeah, it was called, it was called Composing the New Canon. And I think that there was another thing that perhaps, and I haven't studied enough music to fully appreciate this, but I have read Gödel, Escher, Bach, An Eternal Golden Braid. And that's a wicked cool book. it'll get you thinking, and it's pretty fun. And I tend to think a bit recursively, and I like to find abstract connections between topics, and this book encourages that, and or it'll break your mind and cause it to happen.
Oh, cool.
Where it'll just leak out.
Super cool.
Anyway, in the book, there's analysis. So Bach was very into writing canons, and as a pattern in music, it has a bit of a algorithmic recursion to it, how parts of the song define other parts of the song that define other parts of the song that then come back to and loop in on itself.
And yeah. And see, this is really great, because we're getting to sort of a more general idea about how a healthy curiosity keeps an artist alive and sustaining themselves. Mm-hmm. And it can give you new inroads to your craft that you never expected. So even if you are trying to be a specialist, let's just say, like, let's speak to the specialist for a moment, because I don't want to diminish what they've done, because again, as we've talked about, like, by some definitions I would be considered that. I was listening to the Empire Strikes Back audio commentary, because I really like audio commentaries by storytellers, and Irvin Kershner's audio commentary, the director of Empire Strikes Back, it's fabulous. He's so excited. He's so excited. Like, there's the scene when Chewbacca is expressing exasperation because the Millennium Falcon won't go into light speed, like, for the fifth time in the film. And you hear Irvin Kershner, this cheerful old Jewish guy, who's going, look at Chewbacca, look at him, look at him, look at him, look how frustrated he is. You know, it's a joy to listen to that man. But in the 20-something times I've listened to this commentary, one of the things that I noticed was Ben Burtt's commentary, the sound designer. And he starts talking about all the nutty stuff he did to make all these sounds, and not just the sort of like, oh, well, I put a can of tuna fish inside of a glass jar and then, you know, stirred it with a fork. It wasn't just the pure mechanics of it. He starts talking about the different kind of qualities of sound that he's trying to achieve and like what his thinking is behind it. And that's when I made the connection of, yeah, sound is really interesting in movies. I wonder how that applies in comics. And here we are a couple years later, and now I'm, you know, kind of a sound nerd in comics. I think about it all the time. I talk about my classes all the time. I led a 4-hour class for Lean Into Art called FATAM, Designing Sound Elements in Adobe Illustrator. Because it's a topic I'm utterly fascinated with. I was not as fascinated with that before I listened to those commentaries. So, you know, just a more casual interest in something else can lead you down some pretty interesting rat holes in your
it, exactly. It's doing what you can to intentionally apply it to what your current. So you could have a day job that maybe isn't related to your creative pursuits. And perhaps it is like the gentleman who started a restaurant to then inform their writing, where you're just sort of floating in some experience and you're making more things out of it or what have you. Or maybe, you know, your day job is composing web pages and your night gig, you're doing some music and you realize, well, holy crap, there's this connection between the ratios and in the that define the relationships between the elements of this, the sounds in this melody and this web page, the elements that are sized with those same harmonious relationships, where it's by having that filter, I mean, you can connect to different things. And so in some ways, everyone is a polymath if they want to be.
Yeah, I would say the big idea is just, identify whether you're a dilettante or a polymath.
That's there you go. And that's where I just had the little devil angel on my shoulder debating because I really do. And I decided to try to just reach out kindly and whatnot. It's even being a dilettante for a while, as long as you come back from that, that could then inform your other experience. And perhaps that's why that resonates a lot with me, because I think I did that. I got trapped in that kind of situation for a while with, you know, some habits. Mm-hmm. So yeah, but came through it.
And yeah, there's nothing to say that you can't go through periods of incubation.
Yeah, there you go. Other ways to look at it too.
Yeah. I've gone through my periods of incubation as well. So there was like a 2-year period when back in the 90s where I just did not get much in the way of comics done. But over that time, I was investigating other things. I was going to college and I chose classes specifically to make me a better storyteller, right? So, and then I came out of that experience raring, champing at the bit to do more comics again. And I felt like I was better at it because of that, even if I was a little rusty with the pencil. So, yeah. I think the main thing to identify is that if you're not accomplishing something that you want to be accomplishing, deal with that first, and then ask yourself whether it's a good idea or a bad idea after you've finished a few things, right? Does that make sense?
Exactly, and the few things could all be related to the same disciplines, but then you have fresh perspective where maybe you did 5 different comics and it was all more or less doing comics, but then they were on different topics or different genres. And that's going to be create a wildly different experience. And I would say that's a bit like a jack of all trades.
Oh, heck yeah. I mean, cause yeah, you could be a jack of all trades even within comics where it's like, oh, I do noir comics. I do autobio. I do manga. Mm-hmm. I do children's comedy. All those different kinds of comics have very different vocabularies and tool sets that work within their genres or schools of thought, right?
Yeah, so. Definitely.
Well, I think we went around, we took a long walk around this pool, and I think we kind of
And we didn't Hulk out. We did not Hulk out, Jersey.
I thought we'd get angry.
I thought we would too. I felt a little bit angry.
I talked fast a couple times, and that usually means that I care a lot about the subject.
Yeah.
But hey, check it out. I was looking through David's email, and he does have a Twitter handle on here. So cool. We can at least give him that credit. Even if we can't give him a web credit, we could say that he could be found on the Twitters at the Don Quixotic. Quixotic. So, and we'll link to him in the show notes with the question too. So thanks, David. That was good food for thought. Gave us a lot to chew on. Helped us identify Rob's coat of arms, as well as come up with another slogan, the difference between the dilettante and the polymath.
Yeah, excellent. Yeah, so thank you very much for your question. And I agree. I think we went around on that one. And I think this is one of those thematic things that we come back to.
What? What do you mean thematic things?
There's thematic things that after almost 30 podcasts here.
I've really been almost 30 already.
Jeez, yeah.
Pete's.
We come back to certain ideas.
Yeah. 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 I guess you're right. Like a Wagnerian kind of opera where you come back with little rephrasings of the same piece of music notes. I don't know music words, but hey,
it's the canon of the polymath.
There we go. Oh, my lungs still haven't fully healed from that cold. So, hey, guess what? Rob, we got something that we should tell people that if they like this, if they like our way of thinking, if they like our approach to addressing difficult subjects, then they can dig a little deeper. They can dive in a little bit more and plant their heels and lean into their art by going to leanintoart.com/workshops. And we got a new workshop coming up.
Yeah, we do. It's Tyler James, Absolute Consense. And Tyler James has been a comics writer, artist, and whatnot for years. And I actually had the pleasure of in my first tabling experience, tabling next to him, learned a ton. Seriously, like just asked him a lot of things. I mean, I could see like this guy really had a lot of really deep thought in his whole approach. I mean, as far as the things he mentions in his workshop, because I've seen the one at some of his prep sessions, and it's awesome, by the way. I remember seeing him do when I was there a couple of years ago at Baltimore Comic Con, and you know, his notebook and log and whatnot, and his vertical stack of how he merchandises and stuff. It's really cool. I mean, he puts a lot of thought into this. And that's what his workshop's all about. It's 50 strategies to double your fun, triple your contacts, and quadruple your profits at your next comic book convention.
Okay, so this is what I'm going to ask people to do. If you listen to what Rob said and said, yeah, that sounds fine, but you know, I'm going to go to a Comic-Con and I'm going to have a good time no matter what. I'm just going for the pure fun of it. Mm-hmm. I'm going to point people at, and I should write this down so I can put it in the show notes, Art and Story, a show that I used to do years ago with Mark Rudolph of markrudolph.com. We went to the Chicago Comic Con, and this was back in 2008. This was episode 45 from July 2nd, 2008. So ANS 45. And I have been told repeatedly by many different sources from people who were fans of the show who meet me at conventions, and they said, boy, oh boy, when I listened to that episode, you guys sounded so sad. You had a terrible time at Wizard World Chicago. And we did. We had a really bad time. And we had a hard time doing an audio episode trying to summarize our experience where we didn't just sound bitter and resentful and angry. And why did we have a bad time? It was a combination of things. One, it wasn't the right show for us. Two, we weren't prepared for what we didn't know what to expect. And so we didn't properly prepare for the experience. And three, we were also kind of raw to the whole conventioning scene. It takes stamina. It takes preparation. It really takes a kind of preparedness to fully engage in a convention experience. If you're caught off guard, it's gonna hurt. I'm not trying to say this is trying to be like a heavy-handed salesman about Tyler's Workshop. What I am talking about, what I'm trying to get at here is I'm speaking from experience that I've had some really, really bad experiences at conventions, and they're very expensive to go to. So when you pay, as we did with the Chicago Comic Con, $1,000 out of pocket to go to this thing and then have a bad time on top of it, go home $1,000 poorer and unhappy, I really wish, and I'm sincere when I say this. I know this sounds like a sales pitch, but it is, but I also mean it. I wish I would have been able to take something like Tyler's Workshop before I went to Wizard World Chicago. It would have been a completely different story.
And yeah, and it's, I think your sales pitch there is it's spot on, and it's not heavy-handed in that Tyler delivers. It's good stuff. And and it's coming up. It'll be live this May, March 28th, 2012. And of course, will be available for purchase and download afterward as well. So, and if yes, you attend the live, you do get the downloadable video, of course, included.
Yep. Thanks for answering that, because we were getting asked that question. So yes, if you sign up for the class and you have every intention of being there for the live session, which is the best way to be there, if you can be there for the live session to participate in the Q&A afterwards. But if for some reason, oh my gosh, car broke down, oh, I didn't get home in time, I missed the live session, you still get the recorded session indefinitely, no DRM, right? You just download exactly. It and enjoy it as many times as you want. So, yep, that's included in a very reasonable price for this workshop, $65 for a 90-minute session where you're going to get some really awesome hard-won information. So that's a great way that you can support this show. If you like this show and you want it to keep going, you can support us by participating in the workshops, and you get an extra value add. So there you go. Leanintoart.com/workshops.
Well, Jersey, what do you think?
I think that's good. I feel cleansed. I feel purged. I feel like I'm losing my voice again.
All right. Well, we don't want to do that to you.
No.
So I think...
thank you,
survive
Rob.
Survive to podcast another day.
Yeah. Well, thanks, yeah. Rob. This was a fun one.
Cool. Thanks, Jersey.
So, until next time, everybody, I have been Jersey Drozd of leanintoart.com. Oh, yeah, leanintoart.com. Yeah. and Jersey on Twitter.
And I have been Rob Stenzinger, also of leanintoart.com. And Rob Stenzinger on Twitter.
Okay, bye.
Show notes for this episode can be found at leanintoart.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at the user leanintoart, and you can reach us via email at leanintoart@gmail.com. And remember, leaners aren't wieners. Thanks for listening.